all the files of the whole park. It tells you everything.
Sir, he's uploading the virus.
Eagle One, the package is being delivered.
Fancy Bear, APT-10, Lazarus Group, Charming Kitten. These are all the names given to government hacker groups. And if you pay any attention to cybersecurity news, you heard about Russian hackers, Chinese hackers, and groups that are usually called APTs, government-sponsored hackers.
Today, the Department of Justice is announcing a criminal indictment of two hackers associated with the Chinese government.
The FBI suspects the hack was perpetrated by Russian intelligence in an effort to elect Donald Trump. We don't know for sure that they're colluding. All we know is that the hacking groups responsible go by the names Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear.
A Kremlin-backed cyber team known as Fancy Bear has also gone after targets in Europe and Russia.
This week, we're talking with Eva Galperin, the director of cybersecurity with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Eva has been researching APTs for years, investigating these state hackers from all over every corner of the globe. Because countries everywhere are growing their cyber armies, and there's no signs of that slowing down. I'm national security reporter Ben Maku, and this is Cyber. So, pretty crazy few weeks in APT land.
Just like every other week, yep.
So, just to start this off, can you just tell me, what does APT stand for?
APT stands for Advanced Persistent Threat, and is usually understood to mean state actors. Though, honestly, plenty of other groups could probably be described as advanced persistent threats. APTs are usually trotted out sort of in contrast to criminal groups that are doing sort of less targeted work.
Okay, so why do people call it advanced persistent threat for what amounts to nation states?
So the thing that is generally thought to distinguish nation state actors from non-nation state actors, and I will not pause to go on a rant stolen directly from Mara Tam about why we shouldn't call them nation state actors. They're just state actors. Nation state has a very specific meaning in political science. But this is what we do. So I've gone ahead and taken it up. It just sounds fancier. So the ways in which state actors are thought to be different from criminals is that their goals are different. So they have a group of people whose full-time job is breaking into the target's devices or accounts. They start work in the morning. They finish work in the evening. They have access to more advanced tooling because they have more money. And they are willing to be patient, which is one of the reasons why it is called a persistent threat. So it's a combination of the fancier tooling and patience, along with a tendency to be very narrowly targeted and therefore harder to find.
And basically, that's exactly it, right? They're government hackers that their exact job is to show up to the office every single day, go after a target until you obtain what you need, and then go home.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that kind of an interesting thing? Because, people's perceptions of what cyber armies are, or these sort of government hackers, it seems a lot more kind of fancy and clandestine. But, you take the account of China, for example. They've tracked some of these Chinese government hackers, and they see that they are extremely active between 9 to 5 Beijing time, and they break at lunch.
Yeah, this is just somebody's job. And on one hand, that makes it harder to protect yourself against them, because they'll keep coming at you until they gain an advantage. And on the other hand, they're not that ideologically invested in owning you. They're just doing it for work. But one of the ways in which state actors are considered to be very different from criminals is that they're harder to protect against. And the reason that they're harder to protect against is not only because of their fancier tooling and potentially, willingness to spend more money on compromising a specific target, but also because you can't just use the security posture of outrunning the other guy who's trying to outrun the bear. If you specifically are being targeted, then you don't You can't just make yourself a harder target than other activists or other journalists and think that that's going to be enough. And that's one of the ways in which APTs are different from trying to protect yourself from criminals.
And you're also dealing with an adversary that you likely will never apprehend and has the full protection of a state like, say, China or Russia.
Yeah. I mean, what are you going to do? The DOJ issues indictments these days against specific Russian hackers or specific Chinese hackers, and it's unlikely to come to anything. And people involved in similar hacking in the United States against targets outside of the United States think that this sets a terrible precedent because they all imagine indictments coming down, naming them in other countries. And it's not unreasonable to think that this is not a precedent that the U.S. should be setting.
And to be really simple about it, what's the like top 10 nation state hacking groups? Who's the most active? Who's the most advanced? Who does the things that, you know, you could say is sort of advancing this whole geopolitical space online?
Well, it really depends on what you mean by advanced. It turns out that you don't have to be super advanced in order to compromise most targets. Generally, Five Eyes countries plus China, Israel, and I would say Russia are thought to be the most sophisticated actors in the field, and we're definitely thought to be sort of at the leading edge of nation state espionage. There's the famous James Mickens quote in which he goes on and on about how owned you are if you go up against the Mossad. So Israel is considered to be tremendously advanced and highly determined in this area. Same if you're if your attacker is the NSA, you have some very serious concerns. You mostly need to concern yourself with mitigation rather than being able to keep everything completely under wraps. So they're generally thought to be the most advanced actors, but it turns out that you don't have to be very advanced in order to be successful. Iran, for example, is tremendously prolific when it comes to phishing campaigns and campaigns of malware. The same goes for Ethiopia, which we don't normally think of as a major cyber actor. As far as we can tell, the previous Ethiopian government, bought just about every commercial hacking tool that you can possibly get your hands on and had attempted to use them against the opposition. Ever since the change in government in Ethiopia, we expect to see that sort of calm down a bit. We've also seen, you know, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, all at it. Same goes for Mexico. These are all sort of lesser, less sophisticated actors, but they have managed to be really successful.
And that's the interesting thing, too, is that, you know, you look at the Middle East right now and some of those countries, such as Saudi Arabia, are the countries that are actually some of the leading arms buyers in the entire world, so actual kinetic weaponry. But you're also seeing sort of this similar boom of malware and espionage tools in the exact same area.
Not everybody who is running around stockpiling military weapons is necessarily upping their cyber espionage game. But for political reasons, they're, you know, in the Gulf, you've definitely seen an uptick in both of these things.
And why do you think that is?
Well, quite simply, because espionage goes hand in hand with kinetic warfare, and so it's considered to be, you know, part of the package. So when you are engaged in kinetic warfare, you also want to know what your opponents are doing, because it allows you to be more effective at kinetic warfare. If you are in a position as a state where you're trying to, say, avoid kinetic warfare, espionage is also considered to be useful. There's sort of a way of approaching the art of espionage, which is an argument that espionage prevents warfare. It, you know, by allowing states to have sort of a release valve, so that they have options instead of just blowing each other up. I'm not entirely certain that I buy this argument, but I do think that states buy into it, and so they invest very heavily in espionage when they're gearing up for kinetic warfare or if they're in the middle of it. I believe the U.S. Considers the cybers to be another theater of war now.
Well, I mean, that kind of goes to the whole sort of uproar and hysteria around Russian hackers and how they have this sort of almost godlike power to take down the United States government whenever it pleases.
And now we pause for me to laugh. Yes, using their mighty powers of fishing John Podesta, the Russian government has managed to hijack and control all of our elections. That is a tremendous exaggeration. On one hand, Russian and Ukrainian and other post-Soviet actors are extremely active in the space, both in terms of state espionage, spying on each other and spying on the United States. Like the Russian-Ukrainian spying is dizzying if you try to keep track of it. But also, they have a long history of criminal action. There are a lot of cyber criminals operating inside of the post-Soviet states. And in Russia, at least for a very long time, it was understood that if you wanted to engage in online crime, that as long as you weren't ripping off Russians, the rest of the world was fair game and you would have a safe place to sit. As far as I know, that is still the case. Nobody sends me a memo on like what Russian cybercrime is up to, but I try to keep an eye on it. Because of that understanding, there is a large number of criminals with considerable expertise that these states are able to draw on.
Yeah, it's sort of that pooling of talent that happens in Russia, where there's legitimate evidence out there suggesting that, you know, FSB operates some of these clandestine sites where they're able to get some of these black hat hackers to do some of their bidding. Mm-hmm. And it's a great way to, you know, make sure the United States doesn't ever know it's you, or kind of knows it's you, or, you know, we didn't really sanction that one, so sorry.
It allows the Russian government to have a sort of plausible deniability. But there's also just a whole question of how plausibly deniable do they want to get. These days, you can actually have fairly strong attribution, and it's not like anything's going to happen to Russian actors who remain inside of Russia or who don't travel to the United States. There are no real consequences.
So would you say the difference between, let's say, 2010 to present is just, you know, the sheer proliferation of these agencies now and these different governments that have this new capability online? Or do you think that this is something that's always been around and it's just sort of evolving, just like every other country has had the internet and has been doing this ever since?
I do think that the extent to which state espionage has become less expensive, and especially digital espionage has become inexpensive to the point where you can contact a company like NSO Group in Israel or a hacking team in Milan, and for a few $100,000 get access to targets' mobile phones. You're definitely seeing this spread among more and more countries that are not thought to be on the cutting edge of espionage. But I think that the big thing that has really changed since approximately 2010 is not that the capabilities have improved. It's that your average person who is likely to be a target is carrying a tracking device in their pocket. The sort of proliferation of the mobile phone, I think, has really changed everything because it's such an incredibly tempting target, because it carries such a wealth of information about people that you might want to know. And as a result, there's just a lot more to spy on.
Well, that's an extremely depressing way to put it.
I'm here to bring the Christmas cheer.
I mean, I don't disagree. The other thing, too, is just the proliferation of, you know, the Internet of Things as well. I remember I've spoken to intelligence sources in the past that said, you know, in 2007 or 2008, our target platform was three devices. And, you know, you go after somebody post that in the present time, and you have 18 devices where you can get into their Wi-Fi from.
Absolutely. And even more disturbingly, people are installing things like Alexas in their homes. So now you have this sort of always-on listening device that you're using to, you know, turn your music and your lights on and off. I read a story this morning about a guy who had requested all of his information from Amazon under the GDPR, and Amazon accidentally sent him the voice recordings from some other user who had an Alexa. This guy did not have an Alexa, so he absolutely knew that the Alexa recordings were not him, and you could find out a lot of extremely personal stuff about this guy based on that. So that's really disturbing. We're definitely making it easier and easier for states to spy on us by just making more and more information available and filling our homes and our lives with devices.
I heard a story about Vladimir Putin once before where apparently he doesn't use a cell phone, he doesn't touch a computer, and he only issues top secret commands six floors below the Kremlin. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. But
like a mafia capo.
It does, but it does seem like maybe the only way to at least mostly evade your information or having a hot mic situation from happening.
That's certainly one way. And again, you know, Putin is a very different target than, say, you or me. The number of people who would like to know what Putin is doing at any given time is much greater than the number of people who are interested in my life or yours. And the amount of trouble that they're willing to go through in order to achieve that is much greater. So it's really all about threat modeling.
Yeah, I wonder what he is doing right now, actually, now that you ask.
Posing shirtless for a calendar.
Now, what about the way that, let's say, journalists, activists, regular citizens have been sort of an expanded target for most states? Because, you know, look at someone like Khashoggi. There's reason to believe that he was being spied on as well, and that's how he's being tracked. I mean, you look at the journalists that were killed in the CAR earlier this year, possibly being tracked as well. How has that space evolved in the last few years?
Well, it used to be that if a state wanted to physically track somebody's location, they had to send someone to go follow them. But as I said before, now we all conveniently carry tracking devices in our pockets. And so if you can own somebody's phone, you can get their location. And if you can get their location, you can learn an awful lot about them. You can also learn who they're communicating with. Again, this is why the safety and security of these devices is so incredibly important, because they provide this incredible wealth of information that is so useful to states. And having said that, the kind of information that is useful to states is also the kind of information that is used in domestic abuse. For example, abusive partners have a very similar relationship to their targets as, say, an authoritarian government does to a dissident. They want to keep track of them. They want to know what they're doing. They want to know where they're going. They want to know who they're talking to. As it turns out, you can deploy more or less the same technology in order to do this.
And I think, you know, in the midst of, I mean, this week, Facebook, there was evidence to suggest that they were giving up tons of information to some of the other bigger social media companies about their users. Now, you know, and I don't even have to bring up the Snowden leaks, but is it really, can you protect yourself from this sort of prying eye, this big brother? Because in the end, there always seems to be some sort of ace in the hole for the bad guys.
Well, one of the things that I did at EFF a few years ago was I led the sort of rewrite of EFF's privacy and security advice to ordinary people and vulnerable people in vulnerable populations. And it's called Surveillance Self-Defense. And one of the ways in which I try to get people to think about surveillance self-defense is threat modeling, to really sit down and think about what you want to protect and who you want to protect it from. And the reason why this is incredibly important is that trying to protect everything all the time from everybody will just drive you crazy. It is impossible and you should not bother. But that doesn't mean that you should give up. It means that you should really just narrow it down to, what am I trying to protect? Who am I trying to protect it against? And, you know, make all of your mitigations accordingly. For example, if I am particularly concerned about a stalker or a government, I'm going to do very different things than if I'm concerned about ads and adware, or if I'm concerned about my parents spying on me, or my school or my church. Like, these are all different things. These are different people with different levels of capability, and the things that I need to do in order to avoid them are different.
I remember a source once told me in the intelligence community, when it comes to APTs, if they're targeting you, the only thing you can do is slow them down because they're going to get it one way or the other.
It depends. Again, it depends on the APT. It depends on how determined they are to get you and how important you are. And often, buying time is enough, especially if you are a journalist or if you are an activist and you just need enough time to publish your story or to get your action out, then being able to delay the people who are spying on you or trying to understand what you are doing is sufficient. You don't always have to keep your opponent in the dark. You just have to keep them several steps behind you.
So here's one of my last questions I wanted to, because we haven't really spoken about it, but it's the elephant in the room, China. They've been in the news lately, especially when it comes to their APTs. What is China's main sort of geopolitical goal when it comes to using these types of groups?
Well, one of the interesting things about China is that they have a variety of APTs in much the same way that that Russia's APT landscape is a many varied and splendid thing. So many bears. So in the same way as there are many bears, there are many pandas. So in China, we have a bunch of different government organizations that engage in state hacking. There are also sort of para-government organizations that seem to act with the blessing of the government. And there are also criminal organizations, and there's kind of some overlap between all of these things. And in that sense, it's kind of similar to Russia. So you see state espionage being used to uncover sources for stories, especially stories surrounding political issues. You see state spying being used for state control. For example, control of the Uyghur population in northwestern China, in Xinjiang. And you also see criminal activity and sort of corporate espionage, which is sometimes kind of personal and other times is done kind of in conjunction with state goals. For example, stealing intellectual property so that a Chinese company can manufacture an American company or a European company's products more cheaply and therefore get that revenue.
So this is more of a personal question for you and the FF, but do you ever think an APT targeted you or the FF?
An APT has targeted me more than once.
Well, how did you react to that?
I wrote it up. I wrote it up and published it.
I like that. not backing down.
I'm an extremely lazy security researcher. Nothing would make me happier than if governments would send me their malware directly. It saves me the trouble of having to find it myself.
So all the APTs out there targeting Eva, let's get
Eva
sloppy.
Eva@EFF.org. Spell it right.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Last of all, I can talk a little bit about Dark Caracal. So earlier this year, EFF worked with security researchers at Lookout, and we uncovered a campaign of cyber espionage that covered both the mobile and desktop devices that seemed to be based out of Lebanon and was targeting people who would be of interest to the Lebanese government. We managed to track down the physical location from which the administrator was logging into the portal. And it was a specific floor of a specific building run by the General Directorate of Lebanon in Beirut. So we can't say exactly who was behind this campaign, but we can tell you it's coming from inside the room. And one of the interesting things that we discovered was that this was the same infrastructure that had been used for a spying campaign the EFF had reported on a couple of years ago, which we called Operation Manu, the Manu being the cat, which was a wild cat, which is native to the steppes of Kazakhstan. And this particular campaign was targeting people of interest to Kazakhstan. So we spent some time looking at why these two campaigns might be using similar infrastructure. For example, why is Kazakhstan spying on Lebanon? Why is Lebanon spying on Kazakhstan? We think it is more likely that this is a shared infrastructure which is being rented out both to states and criminals. And we've kept track of this for the last couple of years. And we think that this is probably the sort of the new frontier in cheaper and more turnkey solutions to government spying for lower end states.
So basically what you're saying is, I mean, for one, this is an example of sort of emergent country using these types of tools for their own geopolitical aims, but also Lebanon and Kazakhstan were outsourcing it to privateers?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is what we think.
Any idea who that would be?
No, I can't tell you who's running that infrastructure. That is a story for another report. But what I can tell you is that we think this is kind of the new frontier of cheaper and cheaper spying. And it solves a problem that you can see in the hacking team emails from a couple of years ago. One of the problems that the lower end states had was that they had difficulty using hacking team's products. They didn't have enough of a staff that spoke English or that had the training to understand how to use the tools. And this made it more difficult for them to do their spying. So you can look through the trouble tickets that were being sent out, and you can see, I think it wasn't Kazakhstan, it was like Azerbaijan or Turkmenistan. I think it was Turkmenistan, where they just didn't have anybody who could communicate with hacking team's team in order to fix the problem with their implant. And one of the ways around this is just to create a portal. So you have the third party service that makes a portal that you can then log into that makes the spying even easier and requires even less training and even less of a language barrier. So we think that that is what is happening with sort of the lowest end of state spying these days.
Yeah, I believe it was South Sudan, if I remember correctly, that South Sudan had bought those tools from Hacking Team and then they couldn't even use it. And I think even the Hacking Team employees were making fun of them for it.
That sounds about right.
I think that's what it was.
Seems legit.
So having said all this, going forward, what worries you in terms of APTs in the future?
The thing that really worries me about APTs in the future, just from this week, is Amnesty International's report about a campaign of phishing that they have seen with targets in North Africa and the Middle East. And one of the most interesting aspects of this phishing campaign was that they found a way to circumvent two-factor authentication, at least application methods and SMS 2FA. This would not work with like a YubiKey or like any other similar key. And I find that extremely disturbing because most 2FA solutions are vulnerable to this attack. And while we've seen similar attacks from Five Eyes, from extremely what we consider to be high-end actors, it is very disturbing to see this same sort of attack filter down to lower-end actors because it's only going to get cheaper and easier and more automated. And this means that I need to start recommending YubiKeys to more and more people, and I need to start pushing more platforms to support better forms of two-factor authentication. It used to be that just getting platforms to support any kind of 2FA was considered to be a major win. But now, like, you need to support keys. If you don't support keys, you're not really keeping vulnerable populations safe.
So basically what you're saying is, I mean, the attacks are getting wildly more sophisticated and easier and cheaper to do, and more countries are engaging in this kind of tool.
The sharks are getting smarter, yes.
Great way to end it. Thanks a lot. It's good to talk to you.
All right, no problem.
This week's episode was produced by Lorenzo Franceschi Picirai and recorded by Mitch Rackin. It was edited by Dean White. Thanks for listening to Cyber. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, please tell your friends about us and consider giving us a review on Apple Podcasts.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.